What's up, guys? I'm Nobody Special, and we have a special guest with us today, all the way from the Chicken Coop. Doomberg is here. He's the author of the most successful finance Substack publication on the internet, as well as his new venture, Classics Read Aloud, which involves classic literature, as well as Doomberg's own flavorful commentary, as usual. I will put links to both of those down below in the description. And we have a very important topic to talk about because Doomberg centers on finance, energy, and geopolitics. And those three issues are just crashing headfirst into each other right now in South America, here in our own backyard. Areas like Venezuela, Argentina, Colombia. And Doomberg is going to help us make some sense out of what's going on here, as well as the impact for Americans, in particular American farmers and our economy. Doomberg, thank you so much for joining us again, and welcome back to the channel, sir.
It's great to be back. I certainly enjoyed our prior conversation and looking forward to another fantastic one.
Yeah, I really enjoyed our last one. The last time you came on the channel, we kind of went all the way around the world, but we're going to zero in on South America today because there has just been this slew of headlines over the last 2 months, but it's gaining a fever pitch recently. I want to start with what's going on with Venezuela. We've been slowly amassing just an enormous battle fleet in the Caribbean Sea. I'm just going to read off a couple of the ships that we've got there. We've got the amphibious assault ship Iwo Jima, which is essentially a light carrier. The amphibious transport dock San Antonio in Fort Lauderdale with more than 2,000 Marines aboard those two ships. A Ticonderoga-class cruiser, three Arleigh Burke destroyers, a littoral combat ship, a Los Angeles-class nuclear attack submarine. And now, last week, the largest and arguably most powerful warship in human history, the Gerald Ford, and its carrier strike group were ordered to the Caribbean from the Mediterranean. So there's another aircraft carrier and three more destroyers, 13 warships, plus logistics support vessels. This is all under the umbrella of fighting narco-terrorism. What the hell is going on in the Caribbean with Venezuela? And is this really what they're telling us it is?
So I should start with a disclaimer. It's hard for us not to be cynical about what's going on. And so what you're about to hear us discuss is certainly not things that you'll read in the traditional legacy media outlets of the day. But as proof of our sort of the validity of our cynicism, one need look no further than a piece we published on Trump's inauguration day, January 20th, called Misreading the Room. And the social preview for that piece is, if Greenland is the appetizer, might Maduro's Venezuela be the main course? And I start with that opening monologue because this is all quite predictable. As we like to say, the best proof that something was predictable is to have predicted it. And we followed that up 6 weeks ago, I think, with a piece called Mosaic Theory, where we laid out the Trump agenda in the Western Hemisphere, I think, in quite plain black and white detail what was likely to come, all the way from the bailout of Argentina and Malay, that was in there, and the upcoming war with Venezuela, which is clearly going to happen. You don't assemble an armada like that without firing a few guns. At the highest level, what we think is going on is that there's a grand bargain between the US, China, and Russia for spheres of influence, and the Western Hemisphere is America's sphere of influence. And when you're in the bomb-making business, peace is a working capital problem, and Trump would rather not be entangled in the war in Ukraine against Russia. And so sort of a classic regroup and rearm and pick on somebody your own size for a bit. I think the U.S. is going to drop some bombs on Venezuela and attempt a regime change exercise and keep the neocons in Washington well-fed. I note with interest that Lindsey Graham was on television yesterday warning Maduro that he needed to leave, and I hope he leaves, but if he doesn't leave, then we're going to have to drop some bombs. Old tapes, as we like to say. I've been around. I remember weapons of mass destruction. I'm sure you do. And here we are again. There's always a war somewhere. Bombs will be dropped. And sort of on a serious note, the piece we wrote 6 weeks ago called Mosaic Theory, we're very simple around here. We just follow the oil, follow the natural gas, follow the energy, and the truth reveals itself. Venezuela is sitting on a hydrocarbon resource base bigger than Saudi Arabia, bigger than Canada. It's right there. It produces heavy oil that the U.S. Gulf Coast refiners love to refine. They were built to refine that oil and oil from Canada. They weren't built to refine the oil, the light oil from the shale gas revolution. I mean, they can invest and they can adapt, and they have. But you know, you got Vaca Muerta in Argentina, a Permian basin level resource. You have Brazil crossing 4 million barrels a day of oil production. You have Guyana quickly crossing 1 million barrels a day. You have all of the super majors assembled there right off of Venezuela's coast. In the Peace Mosaic theory, we pointed out that Trinidad and Tobago is right there, a natural gas player that punches above its weight. Looks like a giant floating aircraft carrier if you squint a little bit at the map. And so here we are. I think China gets Taiwan, Russia gets Ukraine, and the U.S. gets the Western Hemisphere.
Wow, that's there's a lot to take in there. China gets Taiwan, Russia gets Ukraine, and we get the Western Hemisphere. So,
I mean, I told you we would be cynical, but I mean, it's pretty clear what's going on. Again, the proof is that it is clear enough that we could have written about it 9 months ago.
Well, it is the 2020, so I think a little bit or a lot of bit of cynicism is certainly justified here after what we've seen in the last few years. You touched on one subject that I think is probably playing a pretty big role here, an outsized role. I'm going to bring this map up on the screen. You're probably familiar with this. We're showing Venezuela here, obviously, and then there's Guyana that's kind of like cut in half there. You know, that's the Essequibo region, which I guess there's this ancient feud between the two countries. They've both claimed it. Now, all of a sudden, we find oil off the coast, and Venezuela is claiming the region, I guess, particularly harder than they used to. Do you think this discovery of oil off the coast of Guyana is playing an outsized role in the sudden hostility between Venezuela and the U.S.?
I mean, sure. To be fair, those claims go back to the late 19th century. It's, of course, an artifact of colonialism, a leftover of colonialism, as so many hotspots and border disputes around the world are. Venezuela never dropped its claim. The world kind of recognizes Guyana's claim. And sure, when Exxon and the Chinese and every other supermajor shows up, we wrote a piece called Blooming Flower. You know, the way the oil and gas industry works is when you have a big enough discovery like what Exxon powered through and found off the coast of Guyana, you assemble the supermajors there, risk sharing, all this other stuff. But also then you attract all the midstreamers and service providers and the critical mass of, you know, the flotilla of expertise that is needed to fully extract the bounty from such a resource. And then you start looking around your immediate neighborhood because, hey, we're here already. Why don't we just bloom a little bit and extend the party? And when you look around, Trinidad and Tobago's right there. Again, you know, LNG exporter before it was cool, right off the coast of Venezuela. Venezuela's sitting there. Venezuela used to produce 4 million barrels a day. It barely produces one now. It has the resource base to be every bit as big as Canada, which is over 5 million barrels a day. When we go up and down the southern part of the Western Hemisphere, we could easily find 10 million barrels a day of incremental oil production without really trying. Just restore Venezuela, restore Mexico, develop Vaca Muerta, continue to develop Guyana, you know, take over Colombia, help Brazil grow a little bit more. The Western Hemisphere, North and South America, already produce more oil than the Middle East, and they produce far more natural gas than the Middle East. So there's plenty enough to do in the Western Hemisphere. I think if Trump had his way, he would cut a deal with the Russians, he would cut a deal with the Chinese, and split the world in three and you know, revitalize American manufacturing, rebuild the American military, and be on his way. He can't really do that because the neocons always want war. There's 80% of Washington, D.C. is what we call the uniparty. He does not have majorities in Congress. I mean, there's no distinction between, you know, let's put it this way, the overlap in the Venn diagram of Republicans and Democrats in D.C. is much higher than the media would have you believe. And Trump is the true outsider. And so I think Venezuela is, you know, keeping Marco Rubio distracted while Trump gets done on the economic front what he wants to get done.
Now, you touched on Colombia there very briefly. That's been an interesting, you know, recent escalation, if you will, in the hostilities in South America. Just last week, we had Colombian President Gustavo Petro and his family were sanctioned by the Treasury Department. And another story that I think really got overlooked, because we're kind of getting accustomed to these narco boats being blown up and the footage airing on CNN, but there was a boat was destroyed in the Pacific last week that originated in Colombia. So, you know, this is not just a U.S. Venezuela story here. How does Colombia fit into this? Because they didn't just discover oil off the coast of Colombia recently. That must be something else going on there.
I mean, there's a fair bit of oil and gas resources in Colombia, and the harder you look, the more you find is kind of our overall view of oil and gas. But, you know, the current leader of Colombia is anti-Trump leftist, and, you know, the writing is on the wall. The U.S. has perfected the art of the color revolution. Anybody who follows Mike Benz's great work on Twitter, which I'm sure you do, the history of these spontaneous protests and overthrows of governments and stuff is not exactly a glorious one from the U.S. perspective, but it's real. You have to put it on the board. You have to analyze it. And I think, you know, Trump is just going country by country and friend or foe. You know, Malay's a friend. We'll bail him out unless he loses the election. He did lose the election, as I said on Substack notes. It looks like Vaca Muerta won that election, which is, of course, the name of the big shale resource in Argentina. And the big one on the board, the big unknown on the board is Brazil. I mean, Colombia will work itself out. By the way, whenever they say narco-terrorists, what they really mean is gangs interfering with the development of energy. And so we wrote a piece about Mexico and, you know, how the cartels are all up in Pemex, right? I mean, literally stealing oil, importing diesel, avoiding taxes. You know, they tap pipelines and then suddenly there's big explosions and dozens of people die. And it's a mess. Mexico's oil production is down 50%, right? And there's no shortage of Western supermajors who would love to get into Mexico. And Chevron's already in Venezuela. Exxon with the, you know, the foothold in Guyana. Suriname next door starting to develop offshore resources. Trinidad and Tobago, yes, they're going to host U.S. Navy. Of course, they're going to host the U.S. Navy. They know what's good. Another one that we've been working on is Cuba. You know, there's that situation, given that, you know, Marco Rubio is the son of Cuban immigrants and feels very passionately about the issue. I'm not sure how long the Cubans can hold out from this Hurricane Trump of Western Hemisphere raw geopolitics, but it's interesting to watch in a way. Again, it's hard not to be cynical because like how it's presented in the media is just so plainly not what's actually going on.
So if you'll forgive me, I want to tap further into that cynicism.
There's no shortage of it. So.
I'm enjoying the hell out of it. boats that were blowing up.
Yeah.
You know, look, drive through any major city in the United States and you see the people that are hunched over, strung out on fentanyl. So, I mean, obviously body counts arguably in the hundreds of thousands here domestically, not to downplay the damage that drug trafficking has done to the United States. But let's look at this, what it is. We're unilaterally destroying boats in international waters under the auspices of fighting narco-terrorism. These are basically extrajudicial executions, aren't they? And yet we don't have a lot of debate going on about this in the country, do we? We're just, yeah. Oh yeah, we blew up another boat.
Yeah, you know, again, you're really tapping into the cynicism well today. Look, I think I give Trump full credit for taking on the fentanyl issue head on, making it core to his negotiations with China, slamming the Canadians to do far more than they're doing. We wrote a piece highlighting just what a sieve the Canadian border is and how much fentanyl actually crosses it. And we got, you know, Canadians have a way of sort of thinking themselves as more innocent and pure than their leaders actually are, which is just testimony to the power of British propaganda. Canada being, you know, all right, I'll pull back a little bit. Canada has having a close and historical relationship with the British monarchy, let's put it that way. And so Trump has indeed, as he often does, correctly diagnosed the root problem. And but you're also correct. I mean, there's a literal interpretation of what's going on that would lead you to conclude that these are war crimes. Having said that, I, being sort of a pacifist isolationist, I think war crimes, the phrase war crimes is oxymoronic. All wars are significant crimes. But when you see the video and you see the jugs of chemicals, and you know, like it's hard not to assume that there's some legal basis somewhere in the U.S. In the U.S. laws, Congress passed some anti-terrorism law somewhere that Trump is leaning on, and some judge that was appointed by Obama will put a hold on it, and they'll ignore it. And you know, we're heading down a constitutional crisis for sure. So I lead with my sympathy towards Trump, objectively and I think sincerely trying to stem the flow of dangerous drugs into the United States. The body count that fentanyl has stacked up of mostly military-aged young people is profound. 100,000 a year is devastating. And so what we were doing, what the U.S. was doing, wasn't working. And as uncomfortable as these new tactics may seem, both can be true. They are, I think, objectively war crimes. And nobody's going to be charged. And so a crime isn't really a charge until a prosecutor brings a charge. And who's going to prosecute Trump over this? One thing that is for sure with Israel and Russia and Ukraine and Palestine and now Trump, like the ICC is over. I mean, there's no more international criminal court to speak of. That institution has, you know, passed its best by date.
So if I could summarize it, you know, using my own words, it's no longer a law enforcement action. This is now a military action, a war, not to reuse the 80s drug war, but, you know, we're talking hundreds of thousands of casualties on our side. And once you recognize that it is a war, again, what is a war crime? War is hell. And can you even commit a crime in hell?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And again, you know, you go to certain parts of the major cities in the U.S. and you realize, like, go to Philadelphia, go to San Francisco, go to Chicago, go to Cleveland. It's more than tragic. And at least Trump is trying to do something about it. Maybe he has multiple motives behind it. I do find it a little uncouth for the president of the United States to be posting videos of these targeted assassinations on his social media page. But who am I to criticize Trump? The man was elected to be president at least twice, three times if you ask him. And so he's clearly got more political instincts than we do.
And I would also point out, you know, what you mentioned, you know, these arguments that these are fishing boats that are being blown up. And, you know, you can see in the aerials, they're loaded with jugs. I've actually spent some time on a commercial fishing boat myself. That was my job in a past life. And we didn't fill the boat with jugs of chemicals. You don't put fish in jugs. You don't put bait in jugs.
And look, the same people complaining about this, it's hard to take them seriously when Obama was openly bragging about droning some folks. And they were very much pro-Obama. You know, people tend to look at the news through partisan lenses, and there's just undoubtedly a large section of the population, justifiably or not, who will always take the other side of whatever Trump is doing. And I think Scott Jennings correctly characterizes this as really playing into Trump's hands, because he just goes what Jennings calls 80-20 issue after 80-20 issue. He picks an issue that 80% of the people will support him on, and then reactionarily, you know, the half the population opposes him, and they just make themselves look kind of silly sometimes given what they've opposed. I mean, Barack Obama droned American citizens without any, you know, constitutional rights being considered. And so, I mean, it's not like this is all that different than what's been going on for a very long time.
Yeah, and in an age when you have conservatives championing protectionist trade policy after decades of railing against it, it's a crazy world, the 2020s, and we're only halfway through it.
And let's hope we get to 2030 without a nuke.
Yeah. All right, so we covered Venezuela in pretty good depth there and the narco-terrorism. Now there's another country that has been all over the place in the news recently, and that's Argentina. And there's a lot of overlapping stories and competing interests in Argentina. We had Javier Milei just performed exceptionally well in an election that most people expected him to lose, especially after the Peronists did pretty well in some of the local elections a few weeks ago. What's your take on the economic situation in Argentina, Milei's grip on power, and the status of his agenda?
Yeah, I think it was clear, again, when we wrote Mosaic Theory, that the U.S. would have to fight a rearguard action for Milei. And then they announced the $20 billion and maybe another $20 billion, and who knows what's going on. I saw a great tweet on Twitter. I wish I could attribute it. That Scott Bessent is the first person to invest in Argentinian debt and make money. That election result, kind of, be honest with you, struck us as a little too good to be true.
Interesting.
But, who knows? The president of Guyana magically won a resounding victory as well for a second term. I just think that, sincerely, objectively, Milei needs about 18 more months. And once Argentina becomes an oil and gas exporting superpower, I think much of its fiscal issues begin to dissolve away. You could sell oil for hard dollars, last I checked. And Vaca Muerta is a world-class resource. And I think, I noted, we quoted in the piece about how when, Trump and Bessent were thinking about helping out Argentina, that we put a quote in there about from Chevron itself, basically saying, hey, yeah, we would like we'd like to help participate in Argentina's rebuilding given our position in Vaca Muerta. And so not many people have probably heard of that resource. It's a truly amazing oil and gas resource that's been well known. What was always missing is that critical mass, that blooming flower of super majors and midstreamers and all that other stuff that would properly extract it. But Milei cut pretty reasonable deals, I think. And once the oil and gas starts to really flow from that resource, I think many of the structural issues that have afflicted Argentina will be wiped away. And so this was a pivotal election. It was important for Milei to get by it. He's obviously got his own presidential reelection now coming up next on the calendar. And we'll see how he does.
So that was actually the first I have ever heard that phrase before. What did you call it? Vaca Muerta?
Vaca Muerta. It means dead cow. Oh. And in fact, we first wrote about it in a piece last year called Cash Cow. It's kind of fun to have your own masthead and to be able to speculate about these things. While I'm talking to you, I'll pull up and see when we publish Cash Cow. That's where we sort of outlined just the quality of that resource. Yeah, publish it in September of 2024.
Wow.
And the social preview was Malaysia, Argentina goes all in on oil and gas development. So if you want to read about Vaca Muerta, dead cow, go ahead and find that piece. Just go to the newsletter.doomberg.com homepage and go to the search bar and just put in the word cash. It'll pop right up.
All right. I will put a link to that piece in the description down below for anybody who wants to read about that. Here I am thinking, we have this wild experiment in a socialist hellhole of Argentina in libertarianism. And again, a 2020s commentary there, libertarians winning election. What the heck is that all about? Here I am thinking we want to support this fledgling libertarian, and nope, there's oil there. And that's
so one of the great mysteries of our time. And we believe one of the primary reasons that Doomberg has been as successful as it has been is that so few people start with energy. Look, energy doesn't explain everything, but there's no single variable that explains more. So why wouldn't you just lead with that? I mean, if we can see it from a mile away, again, we wrote Misreading the Room on Inauguration Day, January 20th, while everyone was, watching the proceedings in Washington, we were publishing about how this is probably not a good day for Maduro. And here we are, not quite Halloween, and we've got, let nobody would confuse the armada that's assembled in the Caribbean with the one that assembled outside of Okinawa, but it's sizable, it's powerful, and broadly speaking, history teaches us that when you reach a certain critical mass, the guns start firing.
And, you mentioned how it all starts with energy. Well, there's another take on energy, and that's food, right? What is food but energy for biological organisms? And on the subject of Argentina, the American farmer has been pretty much left by the sideline here, right? We've got the farmer has been the obvious punching bag for the Chinese in the trade war by not buying soybeans from the United States. They're putting pressure on Trump's base. They have been buying soybeans from Argentina and Brazil. So when we come in and bail out the Argentinian government with this $20 billion, maybe $40 billion swap line, farmers are kind of left scratching their heads, huh? And then we have a deal announced recently where we're going to buy Argentinian cattle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, American cattle ranchers earlier this decade were just bludgeoned by the 1-2 punch of drought and the bottleneck at domestic meat packers. I think they were expecting some relief from President Trump. Instead, we're subsidizing their competition. So where does this all leave the American farmer here? And is there any light at the end of the tunnel for them?
Yeah, Chinese owned meat packers, I might add. But I digress. It does appear as though the fate of the American farmer was high on Scott Bessent's agenda when he met with his Chinese counterparts overseas to flush out the framework for what one suspects will be a trade deal, a detente in the trade war between U.S. And China. Malay selling an enormous amount of soybeans to the Chinese advantageously probably wasn't the best look as he was heading, you know, hat in hand to Trump for a bailout. I'm sure that was also discussed with Malay during the recent negotiations. In the end, I think the price action in the soybean market tells you that the market believes that Trump is going to take care of his base. It's hard to be a farmer. The long-term real price of all commodities is lower. And so, but you're correct. I mean, if you did a canvassing of the heartland and went from farmhouse to farmhouse and asked them how they voted, I mean, I don't think you'd find too many Harris voters as you knocked on each of those doors. But Trump has, I think, understood that there's significant pain and there will be probably a bailout. I mean, one thing that, you know, you can always bet on in the U.S. that there will be a farm bill that makes its way through Congress with bipartisan support, not the least because there's two senators from every state. And that means flyover country gets a lot of senators. And that's why we have 10% ethanol in our, it's partly why we have 10% ethanol in our fuel tanks and so on.
So that's why you can't start a weed whacker for the last 20 years because of the structure of the United States Senate.
I got two words for you, my friend, rec fuel. Go get that 90% octane rec fuel off to the side there. Fill it in your generators and your small engines and you'll be just fine.
No gummed up carburetors in the chicken coop, apparently.
That's right. Learned my lesson the hard way.
So there's two more countries that I want to touch on in this South American geopolitical quagmire here. One you mentioned earlier was Brazil. Brazil is an interesting player here, obviously the B in BRICS. So a big effort to de-dollarize. They deal a lot in commodities. The Brazilians were part of the deal involving soybeans with the Chinese to avoid buying domestically. But Brazil also has something of a history with Venezuela. Brazil does not recognize the Maduro regime, and Brazil actually vetoed Venezuela's membership in BRICS when they applied. So is Brazil a player here in this potential conflict with Venezuela? Are they just going to stay out of it, or how do they fit into this whole mess?
Yeah, Lula's a great mystery. I think if Trump had his way, Bolsonaro would not be going to jail, the Trump of Brazil. You know, he's been effectively... What's happening to him is what would have happened to Trump if Harris had won the election, I think is a pretty uncontroversial analysis. And so, but Lula is a sophisticated political operator with decades of surviving, you know, various scandals and ups and downs. And so we'll see the enemy of my enemy is, you know, my friend kind of thought. But Brazil is also, you know, Lula is a big power behind the BRICS movement. The U.S. is obviously, in our view, we've been in World War III with BRICS since 2014, when Russia started dumping treasuries and buying gold. And I think everything else that has flowed from that is just the next battle in World War III. And the B in BRICS is Brazil. So if you pushed me, I think Lula's going to hold out and we'll see if he can. But if you look at the Western Hemisphere and Rubio and Venezuela and Colombia and Guyana, and all the things we've talked about, Mexico, be awfully hard pressed to be the only BRICS nation in the Western Hemisphere if there truly is a sphere of influence deal that was maybe discussed in Anchorage and Trump and Xi might discuss here on the sidelines of this ASEAN summit that's coming up.
So let's say your scenario does play out where, you know, this great exchange of Taiwan and the Western Hemisphere and Ukraine plays out. you know, one of the big insecurities in China, is, besides energy, is food. And if we do see this grand bargain, and Brazil is kind of forced out of BRICS because of that, how does China feed its population in that scenario without Brazil and presumably Argentina?
I mean, the food market is very well developed. I think people erroneously put too much weight on China's insecurity around food. We just got this feedback on a Doom Zoom Pro Tier presentation we put out today. Why didn't you mention food? Because we don't think food is a big issue for China. Look, I mean, if they can just decide to stop buying U.S. soybeans, do they really have a food issue? I don't think so. I mean, I think the global market for food is efficient. China, by the way, you know, bought a major soybean genetically modified seed manufacturer back in the day, Syngenta. Probably a deal that you may not never have heard of, but one that was interesting to us as it hit the news ticker. China has a strategy for everything, and as we said in a recent piece, China would not have pulled the rare earths card if it didn't feel that it was fully self-sufficient in everything that mattered. And it certainly, obviously, it cares about food. China's got plenty of food. The world market for food is extraordinarily efficient. Just look at the price of corn and soybeans as measured in ounces of gold and put a 50-year chart up and tell me whether you think there's enough food for China to buy or not. I think you'll be quite surprised at the shape of that chart.
And, you know, the last one I wanted to touch on is of course, China, as they are the closest thing to a rival to the United States for global hegemony. They're obviously not a direct player in this, as, you know, we don't have Chinese military assets on the ground in South America, thank God, as that would bring the Monroe Doctrine into play. But China is a big financial backer of Venezuela. China does supply military equipment to Venezuela. If this does come to blows in the Caribbean, do you see China playing a role there directly or indirectly?
No, it's just not in their core national interest. And they don't have the power to project that far away from their homeland and their supply chains. I mean, I think in the Taiwan issue, it's quite a different story, of course, because it's right next door. Same with Ukraine and Russia. The only military in the world that has the ability to project power across all four corners of the earth is still the United States military. How long it can project that power is a different story, but China is not going to really interfere, in our view, neither will Russia. They will coldly decide that Maduro is not in their national interest. That's our base case. I mean, maybe we're wrong. We're not happy to be wrong, but we're not afraid of being wrong. But that's our view. I mean, China doesn't have aircraft carriers you can send to take on the Gerald Ford and all the things you mentioned at the beginning. I mean, in the end, you know, dictators like Xi Jinping are nothing if not calculating, and I think they will have looked at the risk-reward profile of such a move and decide against it. If the U.S. really wants to topple Venezuela, there's not much anybody in the world can do about it.
Do you think Maduro survives this, or do you think there's some kind of, I don't know, a Mako or a Taco deal to be made where Maduro manages to stay in power here?
I look, if I read the legacy media, which is often fraught with danger, you read in the Wall Street Journal that Maduro basically offered Trump everything and he rejected it. I think Trump needs a second front for you know, the excess inventory of the military industrial complex to go and blow something else up. And it's probably decided to be Venezuela. And it's, look, I don't say any of these things flippantly or with, you know, underestimating the seriousness of it. I mean, Venezuela is a proud country with a long history with many talented people who live there. But it's just, again, it's hard not to be cynical as perhaps to close as we opened. When you could see it as far back as January that this was going to happen. And then when it begins to happen, it's not like I need to go to the Wall Street Journal to figure out what's really going on. And so if you pushed me, I would say no. The history of strongman dictators who interfere with the exploitation of oil and gas resources when the super majors assemble on their border is not a glorious one. I think we even said in the piece, misreading the room, that we would advise Maduro not to fly private anytime soon, because that's sort of a favorite way for such people to meet their maker. He doesn't strike me as the type to go quietly. So we'll see. It doesn't mean that it's going to be easy for the U.S. or that the U.S. will succeed. I see you're Venezuela and I raise you in Afghanistan, right? To be fair, Venezuela is much closer to home, but still, you know, the U.S. does not have, at least in the past few decades, a fantastic track record in this regard. Iraq, Libya, you know, all the way back to Vietnam, as we like to say internally, Grenada doesn't count. So, but,
A regime change, not exactly a very popular phrase in the U.S. Like, as you mentioned, it hasn't gone so well the last couple of decades. And it's funny, you should also mention fly privately. I just saw an article this morning about how there was clandestine operations to flip Maduro's pilot to try to convince him to land in a friendly country so they could arrest Maduro.
I mean, how did we know to point such a thing out so many months ago? And like, it's just, you know, again, it's just hard not to be cynical at some point. But yes, of course, literally in the picture, in that piece published on Inauguration Day, we have Maduro walking off a small jet, and the caption reads, "Better check that landing gear."
Yeah. Once again, a pretty good prediction, because they didn't go for the landing gear, but they did go for the pilot and try to get him to land somewhere they could grab him. So,
I mean, we didn't hit the bullseye, but we got it on the board.
Yeah, you got pretty close to the bullseye, as close as can be reasonably expected. So we touched on a lot of things there in South America. Are there any big players or maybe pieces of this puzzle that we missed that you think warrant a mention?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't talk much about Mexico, a lot going on there. And of course, we mentioned Cuba. I'm very interested in what ultimately happens with Cuba. There's some interesting oil and gas resources in the northern part of Cuba. Of course, you know, as much as we talked about Lula and Brazil, probably the most energy-rich country in that region is Brazil, growing oil and gas production quite rapidly. But no, I think we covered a pretty, you know, it's a fair bit, frankly, for an hour.
Well, Doomberg, I want to thank you again for taking the time. And once again, I want to plug your Substack, because it is excellent. The Doomberg Substack is the most popular financial Substack, arguably the most popular of anything on Substack. I don't know of anybody that has a bigger following than you. And also congratulations on your new venture, Classics Read Aloud. And I wish you luck with that. I'm going to put links to all of that stuff, along with some of those pieces that you mentioned in our discussion, down in the description below. Thank you again, Doomberg. Any last words before we sign off here?
Yeah, sure. There's several subsects that are bigger than us, but we like to say none better. But no, we really enjoy what we do. We love what we do. Appreciate the opportunity to plug both projects, and always enjoy our conversations and looking forward to the next one.
All right. Thanks again, Doomberg. Folks, check out all those links down below. And everybody, until next time, live small and dream big.